I remember. I was in class my second year at St. Paul's School of Theology and Seminary. I was taking a class called Koinonia, which deals with pastoral care and theology. One of the harder classes that I had to take. It was duly taught by two of the harder, more demanding professors we had. The class met twice a week for about 2.5 hours each time. It was a ball of fun, without a doubt. Because the class was 2.5 hours long, about an hour, hour and 15 minutes into it, they would give us a break, give us a chance to get up, stretch our legs. The class was held in the library building, which was directly connected via a tunnel to the administrative building. And so when they would give us our 10-minute break, we could walk over to the lounge that was in the basement of the administrative building, get a soda, check your mail, whatever. So we'd been given a break on that day, and a friend of mine and I got up, and we walked down to check our mailboxes and get something to drink. And as we approached the lounge, the mail room was right next to it, and Teresa was the lady that worked in the mail room. She answered the phone all day and divided up all the mail for everybody. And she had one of those half doors, one of those doors where the top can open but the bottom can stay closed. That way nobody could get into where the mail was, but she could see everybody and talk to everybody that came by. She was standing at her door crying. As we approached, somebody asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Somebody has flown a plane into a building. We are under attack." I didn't understand what those words meant. We went into the lounge, we turned on the TV, we saw the first images of the smoking skyscraper and wondered what had happened. At that stage, they weren't sure. There was mostly speculation and guesses. We ran back to class and we told our professors what had happened. They said, "If anyone feels the need that they need to leave right now," and one of the students in the corner got up, gathered his stuff, and ran out the door. The rest of us sat there in a sort of stunned silence, still trying to figure out what was happening. About 20 minutes later, they dismissed the class, and some friends of mine and I went back to their room in the dorm, and we turned on the TV, and we sat there watching the news. We saw the second tower get hit. A while later, we watched as the towers collapsed. There are moments, moments that are etched in our collective consciousness, our collective memory, that mark our journey as humanity together. They are rare events. We like to think that they would be around joyous things, like the Royals winning the World Series. But the fact of the matter is there are people right here in Kansas City that don't care and don't know that the Royals won the World Series, sadly enough. And if that is true, then there are certainly many more people in the world that don't know and don't care that our Royals won the World Series. No, events that scar our collective communal spirit the deepest, that mark these cultural moments, are always around fear, it seems. Pearl Harbor, the Kennedy assassination, the space shuttle explosion, 9/11, moments of horror and fear that cause us as a collective society to gasp and remember. Fear is a funny beast. When I worked at the haunted house as a monster, fear was my ally. It was a tool that I used to do my job well. And while working in the haunted house, I quickly realized there are two different types of fear. The first is the jump scare. Now, the jump scare is easy. It's simple. It's down and dirty. I would hide behind a large object, a wall, a door, a tree. And when you came down the path, I would jump and scare you. Hence the name. You would say, "Ah!" and be scared. It's easy. You don't need any setup. There's no buildup. It's simply shock. Jump. Boo. Ah, that's it. It also wears off quickly. Often after a jump scare, the next reaction is a smile because the person knows that you got them, but the fear is over and they relax. They release that tension and that adrenaline. Jump scares are what make people drop their cell phone or pee just a little bit. Jump scares are why I don't take my wife to the haunted house when I take youth to the haunted house. Because my wife's reaction to a jump scare is to punch and cuss. Sometimes at the monster, sometimes at me. So Jackie stays home when we go to the haunted house. But there's another fear, a deeper fear, a fear that reaches down into a person's soul and twists and contorts them. That fear is much harder to find, but it is much more satisfying as a monster in a haunted house. Because that's the fear that if I can tap into it, will cause you nightmares for months. I would watch a group enter the haunted house, or maybe standing out front, and I would watch for signs in the group. Not everybody will display this fear, but there's always one or two. Someone glancing around nervously, standing too close to their loved one, clutching a partner's hand or coat a little too tightly. These timid creatures would realize they were being watched, and they would make eye contact with me in my full regalia as monster. And their eyes would widen slightly and their pupils would dilate, and I would think, gotcha. For these people, the jump scare is too easy. They'll jump, but you can get them better than that. You just have to follow. It's a slow, gradual increase of tension. They know it's coming. They see you, they know what you're going to do, they are afraid of you, but it hasn't happened yet, and it's in that tension that their fear resides, and you watch, you follow, you linger on the outside of their consciousness. This fear is a long, slow simmer. As I would get closer and closer to these individuals, they would try to literally crawl inside their loved one to hide from me. My wife punches and cusses at jump scares, but with a long scare like this, there's no punching. She came to visit me once at the haunted house. I was in full costume. She was standing there. We hadn't opened yet, so all the monsters were gathered around. We were talking. And very gradually, she became aware that one of the monsters was standing behind her. She turned to see this man. He was 6'6". His costume was that of the head of a pig that had been roasted. He was holding a chainsaw. The chainsaw was not running. He was just holding it. But he was simply standing directly behind her. And as she became aware, she reacted like a drunk sailor on shore leave. Expletives I had never heard before. To this day, my wife could not tell you. I worked at the haunted house for 5 years. She couldn't tell you what my costume looked like. But she remembers the pig man. Time and again, the Bible implores us, Jesus commands us, God directs us to not be afraid. Do not fear, the scriptures cry out time and time again. And yet time and again, we fail miserably, allowing fear to rule our lives and drive the hope and strength and courage of God from us. Do not fear, such a simple instruction. We have God, a God who loves us, who we profess protects us and heals us and watches over us and provides for us and defends us and sets us free. What more could we need? Nothing. Our courageous hearts cry out. But then we go back out there to a world full of war and hate and anger and malice and venom, to a world full of disease and disaster, to a world full of monsters and things that go bump in the night. Zika, swine flu, avian flu, Ebola, flesh-eating bacteria, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, HPV, HIV, tuberculosis, ISIS, ISIL, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, terrorists, suicide bombings, nightclub shootings, stock market crashes, housing market collapses, dot-com bubbles, inflationary spending, the dollar is down. We turn on the evening news and pessimistic cheerleaders of the apocalypse glibly bounce from one nightmare to another, pouring gasoline on our fearful flames, and then dance naked round the bonfire in effigy to the mounting tension. And we forget. We forget Romans 8:31. What then are we to say about these things? If God is for us, who is against us? We forget Psalm 118, the Lord is with me, I will not be afraid. We forget 1 John 4, there is no fear in love. We march out into the world and are confronted by monsters. And we cower in fear. And we forget. We get away from the safety and security of faith that we feel in this holy place and get out there and we feel a little unmoored, a little off balance, a little exposed, and we become fearful until we roll back in here next Sunday and we're reminded of God's love and providence. It is not just the unexpected confrontation of struggle and pain, not just the jump scare of bad news and unexpected horrors, but something more. A shift is occurring where it isn't our fear catching us off guard, but fear we are beginning to dwell with daily. Fear we are wallowing in, fear that we refuse to let go. And this constant fear changes us. This constant fear allows us to make bad choices, to make evil choices. And we justify them because we are afraid. It seems we have been afraid for a very long time. And that we have forgotten that commandment to not fear. We let it guide our priorities, our decisions, our politics. When we do this, we must first lay our faith down. Because faith and fear cannot coexist. You cannot hold both. The Bible tells us time and again, you can only serve one master. In order to embrace the fear that is waiting for us, we must set our faith down. That faith of love and grace and peace and hope. And we pick up fear, which leads to anger, which leads to hate. Can't have them both. We set down our faith and we cast for ourselves a new image, a new idol, something to worship, something to keep us warm, something to put our hope in, and it is fear. An idol of fear that guides us and shapes us. We hear things like, be like Jesus. The scriptures tell us, be like Jesus. And on Sunday, when you're holding your faith in your lap, that works. But Monday through Friday, when you're holding your fear, when fear has become your idol, you can't be like Jesus. Fear and Christ cannot coexist. You have to decide which one takes precedence. We come up with excuses. Well, you know, this is the real world that we live in. There are people out there that hate us. There are people out there that want to hurt us. There are people out there that want to kill us. And we have to be realistic. We have to make hard decisions. And sometimes all that hippy-dippy love stuff is great for Sunday mornings, but we live in the reality of Monday through Saturday when terror and horror and monsters can happen. To which I would reply, Jesus lived in a world where people hated him. Jesus lived in a world where people hurt him. Jesus lived in a world where people killed him, and he confronted their fear with love, and he confronted their hate with hope, and he confronted their anger with peace. And thank God he did. I know there are scary things in this world. I remember trying to explain to my 5-year-old daughter what was happening in the world and how people had died. I remember worrying about friends and family. My brother entered the Navy on September 10th, 2001. I remember being scared about what was going to come next. But if we do not lay that fear down, if we do not rid ourselves of such earthly worries, if we do not choose God and not the idol of fear, then we are lost. There is real fear in this world. And we might jump when it rears its head in our life. We might be shocked for a moment, hurt for a moment, worried for a moment, but then we remember. We remember who we serve. We remember we are disciples of Jesus Christ. We remember what God tells us. There is no fear in love.